Tweet at Today SOR.
Criminologist David Wilson met his first serial killer while working as a young present governor, cementing an interest in the phenomenon of murder. He has spent his entire career working with violent men and believes that current anti-crime policies do not work. His fascinating memoir, My Life with Murderers, has just been published, and he joins me now from a London studio. David, good morning to you. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Sean. And may I say, before we even discuss the book, what a moving interview that was that you just conducted. And my condolences also to Laura Brennan and her family.
Absolutely. And we heard certainly from one heroine and one very effective advocate as well in Vicky and Avril as well. But look, to talk about your own life's work, David, you began, I suppose, academically as a historian and then took a sharp turn in the direction of being a prison governor with an interest in murderers. How did that come about?
Yes, it's one of those things, you know, when young people today ask about careers, they almost expect there to be a kind of linear narrative. And I think mine was really just chance. I was playing rugby, Sean, and I became fascinated by the violence that I would have to display on the rugby pitch, and how that violence on the rugby pitch was viewed very differently to the violence that was sometimes not as severe violence of young men in the streets. And that made me interested in how we label things as crime, and how therefore those people who are labeled as criminals get treated whilst they are in prison. What can we do to help them? And I was fortunate enough to be studying at Cambridge, had just finished my PhD, and I had applied to join the civil service and said I wanted to be a prison governor. And literally, therefore, Sean, on the Friday, I finished my viva, and on the Monday, I was assistant governor at Wormwood Scrubs. And it was those experiences that brought me into contact with a serial murderer and cemented my interest in the phenomenon.
Before we talk about the first of those, a man called Dennis Nielsen, some of the first offenders you worked with were sex offenders. Now, did many of them face up to their offences and want to change?
No, there were a variety of sexual offenders who wanted to avoid even thinking about what they had done as being an offence. A number of them had developed what we call techniques of neutralisation, where they would simply justify their behaviour and say that what they were being punished for was normalised throughout society as a whole, and therefore why their argument would be, why pick on me? And certainly when I was dealing with a number of paedophiles, I would find that that as a technique of neutralization was something that cropped up regularly in my discussions with them.
And you say that virtually all of the paedophiles you worked with were sexually abused themselves as children.
Absolutely true. I've never worked with a paedophile who had not been abused as a child. However, that doesn't mean to say that there are people who have been abused as children who will not go on to commit sexual offences. And often it was therefore deconstructing that defence that the paedophile had by saying, pointing that out, that many people go through sexual abuse but would never dream, therefore, of sexually abusing a child because they understood the pain and the trauma that that had caused to them. But I never personally worked with a paedophile who had not been abused, and I also worked with several paedophiles who had been chemically castrated but who would still go on to commit sexual offences against children.
The first serial killer you met was a man called Dennis Nielsen. Now, remind us about what he did and what you concluded about him.
Well, the very first person that I met, I was 23 years old. Very first serial killer I met was a man called Dennis Nielsen, who had literally just been convicted of murder, which is why he moved from the prison that he had been on remand in London to Wormwood Scrubs. The numbers of people that he killed are still a subject for some debate. He at the time told the arresting officers that he had killed 15, whereas in fact we think now that he had killed 12 young men, many of whom, but not all, were gay, men that he would pick up in various pubs. He'd bring them them back to the two places in London that he shared during the period of his killing cycle, and then he would give them more alcohol, they would become unconscious, and then he would mostly strangle them, and then he would dismember their bodies and flush body parts down the toilet. So Dennis Nielsen was a particularly extraordinary killer, and my work with him was unusual in the sense that professionally he wanted to talk to me about why he had done what he had done, because in my experience of working with serial murderers, they by and large are silent and uncommunicative. They don't engage in conversation. They don't want to try and understand why they have done these dreadful things. Nielsen was unusual in that respect, although I didn't accept, Sean, the kinds of rationale, the reasoning behind what he wanted me to accept as to why he had murdered.
And one of the things I think you concluded in his case, and indeed others as well who are serial killers, that you can't believe much of what they tell you.
That's absolutely right. And therefore, a lot of the FBI, that first wave of FBI profiling, was predicated on interviewing 36 murderers and serial murderers. And then on the basis of what they told the FBI agents, they developed what we now know as offender profiling. And even at the time, because of my experiences, particularly with Nielsen, I remember thinking that's a very poor basis on which to base an understanding of the phenomenon of serial murder. And of course, as you know from the book, My Life with Murderers, over time I've tried to get people away from thinking about what might motivate the serial killer to begin to understand that if we want to reduce the incidence of serial murder in our culture, we start looking at who it is they're able to repeatedly target. We should look at the victim groups as opposed to what might be motivating the killer.
And that would include, from certainly his actions, young homeless men who are gay and other vulnerable people. Would it be women as well?
So there are only really five groups, whether we're talking about Ireland or whether we're talking about the United Kingdom. There are really only five groups. Women dominate four of those groups. The group of men that you've just drawn attention to, the only group that are repeatedly targeted are gay men. And therefore, you begin to think about homophobia and the part that homophobia plays in creating in our culture that creates vulnerabilities so that gay men are targeted. And in relation to the two dominant groups of women who are targeted by serial killers, they are sex workers, who are repeatedly targeted over time, and in particular, women who are over the age of 60. I used to describe them, Sean, as elderly women, and then I turned 60 myself, and I thought, well, I'm not elderly. Why am I describing people because they've turned 60 that they're elderly?
Women... Go ahead, yes. Sorry.
So it's the how cultures silence people when they have when they're 60, 65, 70, 75, how those people of that age, women of that age, are silenced by our culture, where nobody is prepared to question why that elderly person, in inverted commas, might have been perfectly healthy one day but ends up dead the next. And of course, when I'm saying that, I'm thinking of Britain's most prolific serial murderer, who was the trusted local GP, Dr. Harold Shipman.
Indeed. Just before we leave Nielsen, what was his rationale to you, or what his defence of what he did?
He argued an argument that I didn't accept, that he killed for company. He said that what he couldn't face was waking up in the morning and being by himself again. So he killed for company. And of course, as you can immediately yourself understand, all of your listeners will understand, my very first point that I made to him was, but you weren't in the company of somebody who was sentient and alive. You were in the company of a corpse. And therefore, I began to have to deconstruct the kinds of rationale that he was wanting to talk talk about to explain why he repeatedly killed.
Now, you met some other killers who were, I suppose, less gruesome, although it didn't probably matter to their victims. But you worked, then you moved to a place called Hunter's Combe, I think it was, a youth custody centre. And you met a young man called Jimmy, who came from not the kind of background you would expect a killer to come from.
So it was Hunter Combe.
Yes.
And at the time it was, people will be familiar with the term Borstal. It was just changing from the Borstal system into what then was known as youth custody centres, now are known as young offender institutions. And I met Jimmy, which is not his real name. I've had to change his name because he committed a murder when he was 15. And I met him when he was 19. And I actually met him on the rugby pitch because in the those days, prison staff would often play sport with the prisoners, and I played rugby, and Jimmy was an incredible rugby player, and that encouraged me to look at his file. And then I realized that 4 years prior to my meeting of him, he had murdered an elderly man who had invited him back to his home so that Jimmy wouldn't need to sleep rough. And of course the story unravels from there, doesn't it, Sean? Because of course Jimmy was very much a public schoolboy. He was somebody that went to a fee-paying school, in other words, and came from a very nice middle-class family. And so my work with Jimmy was to try and understand why he would want to kill the elderly man who had befriended him, and would he ever be safe to release again? And I'll give the story away. As you know, in the book, I was part of the process that encouraged Jimmy to go to an open prison. He was subsequently released, and he now runs a company employing 15 men.
Now, many of the murderers, or some of them that you would have met, were psychopaths. And again, that's a phrase or a word that people use, perhaps without understanding what it is. So how many of them were psychopaths, and how can they be identified as such?
So you're quite right. There's a great deal of popular misunderstanding about what psychopathy is. And again, the book tries to guide the reader through what actually psychopathy is, which is a personality disorder. It's a personality disorder which will have a cluster of three different sets of factors. The things that, without going into what those clusters of factors might be, if somebody out that's listening today was to encounter somebody and they had two very different feelings, that they would find that this person was actually very charming, they'd find that this person was very attractive, that this person was showing a great deal of interest in them, they were fun to be around. This person, therefore, is somebody who is able to become close in a very short space of time to the person. And that would probably give women pick this up much more quickly than men. That woman will probably think, you know, this guy's just too good to be true. And it's usually that dissonant feeling that tells you that you're in the company of a psychopath, that this guy is just too good to be true is actually what is a warning bell for you that should be making you think very carefully before you get involved too deeply with the man who's charming you in the club or in the bar.
And then you went to a prison called Grendon, where it operates a kind of, I think it's called psychodynamic therapeutic community. You work with some pretty serious individuals there. Tell me about Paul Brumfitt.
Paul Brumfitt was somebody who was, as far as everybody in the prison was concerned, you described it absolutely accurately, Sean. It's a psychodynamic therapeutic community, which means that men go there for therapy, for treatment. And the treatment isn't instantaneous. It takes a number of years. And Paul Brumfitt was somebody that we all felt had absolutely turned the corner in his life, that he was no longer as risky as he had once been. Paul Brumfitt had committed murders. So Paul Brumfitt was somebody who was a very dangerous young man indeed. But by the time that he had gone through 4 years of therapy, we thought of Paul Brumfitt in a very different way. Paul Brumfitt was somebody that we felt was a good advocate for how therapy can help very violent men stop being violent. And of course, as you know from having read the book, the next time I heard, I moved on from governing at Grendon. The next time I heard anything about Paul Brumfitt was when I saw his picture in the newspaper, and he'd been released from prison. His life had become chaotic again, and once again he had tragically taken the life of another person. So therapy isn't a cure-all, and what Paul Brumfitt's story made me realize is that I don't work in a field that has a predictive science behind it. I work in a field where individuals such as myself are still going to have to exercise very careful judgment.
You believe, do you, that there are some prisoners who should never be released?
I absolutely do believe that. There are some prisoners who might become rehabilitated in the sense that they are no longer a risk to the public. But what they have done to get into prison is so heinous. I just feel that society has to have a way of being able to separate that kind of offender from the rest of society. And there are some prisoners whom I have worked with that I'd never want released because they have done things that are so dreadful, and they have never expressed remorse or gone through any treatment or rehabilitation programs. Therefore, they would still be a risk when they were released back into the community, and they would be a danger to you, to me, to your listeners, to our families. And I just don't believe society should take that risk with them.
Now, I think the prison population has gone up significantly since you started as a prison governor. But
it's doubled.
Up to what, 80,000 or something like that at this stage?
Over 80,000 now, Sean. It's 84.
Yeah, and one of the things you say is that the killing of the toddler Jamie Bulger, which many people will remember well, it sharpened, it shaped, I should say, tougher attitudes to crime in the UK, leading in particular to the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act of 1994. And in some ways was politicised by people who wanted to appear tough on crime and tough on the causes of crime.
That's absolutely true. But let's deal with the murder of James Bulger first. It was a dreadful crime, and it was appropriate that the two young boys who killed James Bulger should have been punished. I always say I don't want to be tough on crime or soft on crime. What I want to be is smart on crime. And by being smart on crime, you use your most severe punishment, prison, as sparingly as you need to, because it's not only your most severe punishment, it's also a costly punishment. It's also a punishment that sometimes doesn't treat the underlying causes of why somebody committed crime in the first place. And because our prison population is at its highest ever levels. It's at its highest ever levels, whether we're talking about England and Wales, or indeed in Scotland. Forgive me, I don't know the figures for Ireland off the top of my head. It's not because we're incarcerating serial killers and murderers. It's because we're incarcerating people who are often got mental health problems. They've also got problems with addiction. They have been committing petty offending, often for some, because that's the way that they can survive. They've got problems with housing. And so I don't think prison should be used in those circumstances. I think we keep prison for when we need to use it.
One other question, and time has caught up with us, and this has to do with the Dunblane massacre, where Thomas Hamilton, in 1996, he used four licensed handguns. He killed 16 children and their teacher, injuring another 17 people. And you say there's much in Dunblane which is prophetic of the mass and spree murders which were to come.
And if we think tragically about what's happened in Christchurch, I won't name, as requested by the Prime Minister of New Zealand, I won't use his name, but in the same way I think about Dunblane, I think about Christchurch. These are men who are trying to reorder the world in a way that better suits their needs. And their needs are to be at the center of that world and to have control over that world. And we should simply identify these men as being narcissists who are seeking power and control.
It's been fascinating talking to you. It's been fascinating reading the book, David Wilson. It's called My Life with Murderers, Behind Bars with the World's Most Violent Men. And it's published by Little Brown UK, selling for £20 sterling. And I should say as well that David's documentary about Jack the Ripper will air on BBC One at 9 o'clock on the 4th of April, coming up in about 3 weeks' time. David, thank you indeed for joining us, 2 weeks, in fact. Lovely talking to you.